This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Whiplash, you don't know which way it's going. Whiplash, what just happened today? Who fired the government? To enemies and enemies to friends.
Best friends become enemies. Enemies are friends. Business is great. Oh, the market tanks. Winter yesterday, summer today, and winter again. New rules tomorrow. Welcome to Whiplash, the time of self-inflicted wounds. What to do? We talk with Dana R. Fisher, expert in social action and author of Saving Ourselves. Then senior Australian scientist Dr. David Karoly with the Frank View from Down Under.
The last time we had warmer temperatures than we might get in 2100 due to the drill, baby drill scenario, what I will call the, if you like, ongoing greenhouse gas emissions from burning fossil fuels, the planet would hit 4 degrees or more of global warming. The continents would hit 6 degrees or more of global warming. Antarctica would hit 6 degrees or more of global warming. The West Antarctic ice sheet would lead to 10 meters of sea level rise. That would be a very different planet.
What you will find, knock you back by evening, blow your ever loving mind. Strap in now, smashing common sense. Get ready for the hurricane. Get ready for the heat. Captain Whiplash in the pilot seat.
After an accident, as you come out of shock, your brain serves up two immediate questions. Where am I? Is there still danger? Much of the world is in shock right now, and this is a perfect time for the book, Saving Ourselves, From Climate Shocks to Climate Action. The author is Professor Dana R. Fisher, director of the Center for Environment, Community, and Equity. Dana is an expert in the study and practice of activism, just what we need. From Maryland, Dana Fisher, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
You spent decades right alongside activists, but also writing reports for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, so you know what works. As we witness the attempted murder of climate science and healthcare in the United States, Dana, what are you hearing through your contacts?
Well, I'm hearing that people are exhausted, frustrated, anxious, worried. And I'm also hearing a lot of people are angry. And I have to say that the thing that's giving me the most hope right now is how there is a collective level of anger that's growing across the country as our, you know, our scientific institutions, including universities, are under attack. We know from research that anger actually is a great motivator for action and engagement. And, you know, a lot of what I study is about engagement and activism. And we know that that helps to bring out the masses, which is what we need in this kind of moment.
We also broadcast outside the United States, in Canada, the UK, Australia, and beyond. And the feeling here is that perhaps what's going on in the U.S. will shock people here into more activism to protect the nature. Or on the other hand, the same mental poisons could spread through social media to infect Canada and the UK and Europe and beyond with climate denial. Which way do you see it going?
Well, I know that last time we had a Trump presidency, and actually the book that I wrote before Saving Ourselves was called American Resistance, where I documented the resistance to the Trump administration and its policies. And what I know then was that in a lot of ways, many other countries saw what was happening in the United States as a cautionary tale. We saw a lot of pushback to a shift to the right in many countries. I'm very hopeful that we're going to see something very similar this time around, although there certainly is misinformation around climate change spreading around the world. And as you mentioned, social media plays a big part in that, as well as the ways that we increasingly get our information through echo chambers.
And key to your new book, and step one for all of us, is understanding that institutions will not save us. Now, at times you work through those institutions in high-level conferences. Why should we give up hope that a better government or the IPCC or even a group of green billionaires can save us from this crisis?
Well, I mean, what I find in my work is that governments can push back against fossil fuel interests and start to address the climate crisis, but they're not going to do it on their own. And what I document in the book, and that, as I've talked about in other parts of my work over the many years I've been doing it, is that basically at this point, governments are beholden to privileged interests, many of which are fossil fuel funded or fossil fuel connected, that have access to resources and power and are continuing to have a stranglehold on decision making. So the only way to fight against that is for us to put pressure on our electeds, to put pressure on the state and the market to shift in a way that actually meets the demands of the climate crisis, right? And to actually get us to the systemic change that we know is necessary. So it's not that the state can't save us. It just will not save us without us pushing it and requiring it of our elected officials and of our democratic systems.
Well, everyone should assess their climate footprint and act to reduce that. You did it in your own household, but then you say individual climate action can't save us. So why bother?
Well, why bother is because we can certainly contribute to making it better or worse. It's just that we can't do it alone. Like I individually, as I talk about in the book, I can't do it alone just by going, you know, getting my house off the grid, because every time I leave my house, I'm part of a system. And a system that is fossil fuel funded and that is going to continue to be fossil fuel dependent until we shift away from fossil fuels, which obviously the United States is moving in the opposite direction right now. So we will not be seeing the United States go in that direction without a lot more pressure from citizens.
And as you say, though, we need something called an anthro shift. What is that?
So an anthro shift is a change in the way that the government, businesses, and civil society interact with one another. And it basically determines what kind of leads decision-making in a country or in a society. And I say we need an anthro shift because as the research that I've done with my colleague Andrew Jorgensen, as well as alone, has documented, an anthro shift is a moment when there is this window of opportunity that opens due to people's personal feelings of risk that leads us to push for there to be different priorities taken. In this case, priorities towards the environment, priorities towards shifting away from fossil fuel dependence. And when there's an anthro shift, we can see a reorientation of these different social actors so that we can get what we need. Right now, though, we are very much in a system that is doing a lot of things to give extra, you know, credit to the fossil fuel interests. I mean, we have subsidies towards fossil fuel interests. At this point, we see not only the reduction in subsidies for clean energy and for, you know, transitioning away from fossil fuel dependence, but we see actually an administration here in the United States that is pushing to try to figure out ways to extract even more fossil fuels. So what we really need right now is an anthro shift away from that. And what I talk about in the book, and I found in my research, is that is likely to be driven by the pain and suffering of the experience of climate shocks, which, you know, people around the world are experiencing. We've seen a number of climate shocks in the United States, but they're happening all over the world. And what the research shows us is when people personally experience the effects of climate change in the form of a climate shock, that is an extreme event like a wildfire, a drought, a flood, a tornado, et cetera, and so forth, we know that no matter their political ideology, they're much more supportive of climate action and more open to understanding and supporting climate science.
On December 7, 1941, Japan launched a deadly surprise attack on the American fleet in Pearl Harbor. Just 2 months later, by order of the American government, the auto industry stopped making cars, commercial trucks, or even car parts. Production changed to military, of course. But it took a wave of fear and anger sweeping across the U.S. population to make that big change happen. Is that part of your argument in saving ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you're describing here is an anther shift, right? The anther shift in that case was due to the risk associated with the fear of being under attack by a foreign country, right? The anther shift that I'm talking about is likely driven by, you know, the experience of climate shocks, although certainly, as we've talked about in other places, not in saving ourselves, anther shifts can be driven in, you know, by many other things. During the COVID pandemic, as I've written, the world experienced the anther shift. But an anther shift can reorient the different social actors in one direction, and then it can go back again because it's multidirectional. And that's why we need a shock so big that it puts us on a path long term. One of the differences between the example that you mentioned here with Pearl Harbor versus what I expect we're going to see around the climate crisis is that being under attack by, you know, a foreign country is very different from the local experience of climate shock. So that while people around Los Angeles might be feeling the effects of a climate shock after the wildfires there, and they may be reorienting their priorities, and this window of opportunity for climate action may have opened there, but that doesn't mean that people in Arkansas or Wyoming or here in Washington, D.C., where I live, are experiencing it the same way. So it's going to be more localized, and that is much more difficult to create a political will for climate action nationally that way. But if we wait so long that there is a national disaster, as the science tells us, it may be too late.
It sounds almost like we just have to wait until more things break down and humans are desperate, and then the best will come out in us, which you did see in your book, and we will work together. But often history does not agree. Some popular revolutions became violent, like the French and the Soviet communists, and then they fell into dictatorships and war. As a sociologist, what makes you think it's different this time, that we could have hope in this?
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that we need a revolution. I'm saying that what we need is this kind of a bottom-up social change that is prioritizing climate action because of the threat of the climate crisis. You know, we could go in many different trajectories, and we're also experiencing this alternative crisis right now in the threats to democracy, which really changes the dynamic quite substantially, so that I think that there are lots of people who are mobilizing and concerned about threats to democracy along with threats to science and threats to climate action and, you know, and a retrenchment and steps away from the climate action that even the Biden administration took just recently. So what I believe is that the more people get engaged in their communities and start to connect and work with one another to push for the type of climate action that is necessary, the less pain and suffering there will be and the less likely we are to slip into, you know, further autocracy and to see the kinds of examples you're talking about from other countries. However, that's always a risk.
Well, as you've said, we already see amazing climate-induced disasters in the United States and around the world, yet the official line of the new Trump government is this is all a hoax, and so is green energy and return to your gas guzzlers. Maybe if the shock is too great, we all just instinctively draw back into old ways. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't believe that the Trump administration is the product of a climate shock or the expectation and understanding of disasters associated with the climate crisis. And that's why I say there's a polycrisis going on right now. But in terms of getting us where we need to go, before the Trump administration took office, before the 2024 election, many people asked me about what would happen if the Trump administration took power. And I said, although we have seen a mobilized climate movement, it has been very small. Small but mighty, but still not big enough and not mobilizing the masses. And what I said before the election was that if Trump comes into office, we will see a much more coherent and empowered movement on the left, which is what I documented in American Resistance. And American Resistance, during the first Trump administration, climate and climate activists played a big role in the resistance, but it was much more of a coalition across the left. We're seeing a similar coalition forming this, you know, this time around. Although, you know, it will be obviously very different from the first Trump administration because the policies are different. But that actually opens up more opportunities to push for the type of mobilization that we need before we can get to the other side of the climate crisis. So in some ways, the fact that things are getting so bad gives me hope that we can actually affect change sooner than probably otherwise.
One instinct, and I see this repeatedly online, is for everybody to just quit. Don't go to work or schools or shopping. Just turn out in the streets to protest. You helped promote the Stand Up for Science protest last week. Tell us about that, please.
Well, I mean, I should just say that, as somebody who studies protest and activism, which is one of the other big areas where I've written quite a bit, whenever there's a large-scale day of action, I always promote it. So I wasn't specifically promoting Stand Up for Science. I'm also promoting many other protests that are happening. I just try to get attention to it. What I do say is that when there is this need for a mass mobilization to push back against power, sometimes we need to step out of our everyday lives, step out of our normal consumption patterns, participate in strikes, participate in protests, to demand the kind of action that's needed. Sometimes that is the only way to get the attention of those in power to make them understand that they have to actually listen to our concerns. Because, you know, when people in power do not listen to the concerns of the people, which I would argue is what we're seeing right now during the Trump administration, that can lead to real problems in our society and certainly a shift away from democratic practice and democratic ideals. So I think that they're, you know, one of the reasons that I'm drawing attention to these mobilizations is to make sure that people know, one, that they should not be full of despair because there are opportunities to get involved and find like-minded people, which is one of the big things that a protest does. I mean, it doesn't solve the problem, but it does give you this sense of collective identity, which is really important for maintaining a movement as a movement pushes forward for social change. But, I mean, at the same time, I also would just say that if things get bad enough, there's an argument to be made that we shouldn't be following business as usual and we should be doing whatever we can to push back against power to stop the crisis. And, you know, the crisis is worsening every day.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog. Ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
This is Radio Ecoshock. Our guest is Dr. Dana R. Fisher. We're talking about her book, Saving Ourselves. And it is sad to read in that book about innovative and inspiring protests that happened at international climate meetings, like the Human Dike at The Hague in 2000. In the last 2 years of COP climate meetings, they were held in authoritarian states. There were no crowds to chant or call out. In fact, protesters were not allowed to speak above whispers off to one side. Hundreds of fossil fuel lobbyists attended, though, and they got VIP treatment. Is that part of the climate movement over?
That is a wonderful question. And I would say that, I mean, to some degree, We can only know for sure as we move forward in time. I mean, the next climate negotiations is going to be in Brazil. The leaders of the negotiations actually said to me that they're expecting and preparing for a more vibrant opportunity for civil society to engage. I'll be curious to see how that works out. The climate regime has really given fossil fuel interests a big seat at the table in recent years, and they'll have to change the whole policy to make it go back to the way it used to be. And I've studied international regimes to look at those that are most democratic, transparent, and engaging with citizens and providing opportunities for citizens to participate. And the climate regime used to be one of the best. At this point, it's not at all. So it will have to change. I am not confident, however, that the international policymaking process is the best way for us to act on climate at this point. I think it's much more likely that there will be positive outcomes from actions that start at the local level, in local communities where we know one another and we know what is needed and how to do it best, and our voices can be louder. It's really hard to get your voices heard when you're at an international negotiation where there are actually not hundreds, but I would expect thousands of fossil fuel lobbyists who are there. So in those cases, it's very difficult, particularly when there's not a lot of transparency or democratic practice in the regime. So in some ways, starting local and working up to regional and national to then participate internationally might be the best way forward.
And you write, quote, without government intervention, it is very hard to change individual behaviors. So right-wing libertarians are not going to want to hear that, and I think some behaviors just changed by TikTok creators rather than the government. But even so, it sounds like the very hard way is our last hope. What is that very hard way if we can't get government intervention, if the government is actually working actively against us?
Well, if we can't get government intervention and we can't find, you know, I mean, you did mention this idea of the benevolent oligarch, right? But the problem is that, well, first of all, it's really dangerous to put all your faith in, you know, a green oligarch, because they can turn and you never know what you're going to get when you invest in an oligarch, right? I mean, I think we're learning that the hard way right now. So the best way forward, which is also the hardest road, but the most likely road forward, is a forward, you know, moving forward by mobilizing the masses and mobilizing citizens and community members and friends and neighbors and schools to do the hard work of saving ourselves. And like I talk about in, you know, in the book, I talk about it in my TED talk, as unfair as it may seem, the future is up to us, and this, and we're the ones who have the power here to lobby on behalf of our own interests. But nobody else is doing that. And I think that the experience we've had in the past 5 weeks, 6 weeks now of the Trump administration is that that's not going to change, at least not in the next 2 years, let alone the next 4 years. So what we really need to be doing is doing the hard work of building infrastructure, starting at the local level, to follow through on what we care about and protect it. And in this case, you know, I would say the climate is right up there as something we need to protect, because it also will protect the future for our children and our children's children.
I think everybody should see your short and powerful TED Talk on YouTube. It's called How to Be an Apocalyptic Optimist. But what does that mean, apocalyptic optimist?
Well, being an apocalyptic optimist means that I do have hope, but I believe that hope only comes from being realistic about the path we're on and recognizing that it's going to get worse before it gets better. There's a lot of bad trend lines that we are experiencing right now, many of them related to climate, but some of them also related to democracy. And the science is clear. We are on a, you know, as the UN Secretary General says, a highway to hell, right? What being an apocalyptic optimist is about is it means that we recognize that that's the path. We don't deny it. We don't pretend it's not happening. We recognize that things are going to get worse. And then we draw hope from understanding that as the world warms, there's a lot of evidence that more and more people will take to the streets to push back. There's some recent research that just came out talking about in Florida how people who experienced tropical storms that were exacerbated by climate change, after they experienced them, they were much more likely to support climate action, no matter who they voted for the election, no matter what their political ideology. And as much as that means we have to wait till things get worse before they get better, it also shows that as they get worse, there's opportunity for change and for us to go in the right direction. So that's what being an apocalyptic optimist is all about. You know, all of us need to acknowledge where we are and where the world is going, because if we're not realistic about the path we're on, too many people are going to be caught off guard. And when we're caught off guard, it provides real opportunities for misinformation. We've seen it in many other places after disaster hits and, you know, around climate, and that would be a really bad path for us to be on. So I want us to be realistic, and that involves being a little apocalyptic before you get optimistic.
It would be cool to take a year to study your decades of work and publications and work out a plan for activism that really works. It seems like on the right, Project 2025 did take that time. They have a plan. But now here we are. We're objecting, and most people, I think, do object. They know we're in a climate emergency, but we don't have a galvanizing national figure at this point, I don't think. So you're the expert. What can we do now on the hurry up as the emergency is here?
You're absolutely right. The folks on the right have been planning for this time since at least Obama won in 2008, right? Project 2025 is born of a long-term project to study and understand how to dismantle the American state, the American bureaucratic state. And many of us didn't take it seriously and pay enough attention. I, too, did not pay enough attention. I mean, I was talking about it before the election, but it was in the works for quite some time. So I have to say that at this point, you're right. We don't see real, you know, we don't see a clear leader or a coalition of leaders forming that is the obvious path, you know, will be the obvious leader to take us on the path forward. What I think the best thing we can do right now, again, is to build from our communities and to invest the time in our communities to find those leaders in our communities. Because the best thing we can do, and I, you know, I understand and I'm supportive and I'm friends with a number of people who are influencers online, but unless you have local connections to community, the level of success you can have in building a movement and affecting real social change is very limited. So what I think we need to be doing right now is investing in our communities and using that to build capacity and power. And then take that power, you know, and force what we need to force to make the changes that are needed. Do it at the local level, the regional level, at the congressional district level, state level, all the way up to the federal level. But I think that the real way to do it is to start local and push up, because that's where we have our power. That's where we're based.
As we start to wrap this up, I'd like to open this up more to you. What else should we talk about, Dana Fisher?
Well, I think that there's been a lot of discussion in recent years about whether or not people should be throwing paint on protective coatings of art. And unfortunately, that's been too much of the conversation. And yes, there are activists who have gotten involved in what we call a radical flank of the climate movement. And some of them decided to do these performative and what I call in my book, shocking acts as a way of getting media attention for the climate crisis and for the movement. And it has been very successful at getting attention. It's also very unpopular. And as I talk about in the book, it's unpopular just like the sit-ins were unpopular during the civil rights movement. But I think that the conversation should not be focused on one particular tactic or one particular person or one particular group. There is a really dense ecosystem of organizations fighting back against the climate emergency. And we need to recognize that they all have a role to play, and anybody who can come up with an innovative and peaceful way of trying to get us where we need to go, we should be supporting, not talking down any of them. Because at this moment, we're in an all-hands-on-deck moment. This is a climate emergency. It's going to get worse before it gets better. So let's not knock one another down. I can tell you, when they were building Project 2025, it was all about, you know, everybody doing their part and working together, not about knocking one another down to see who's the best person.
From American University in Washington, D.C., we've been speaking with the director of the Center for Environment, Community, and Equity, Dr. Dana R. Fisher. I hope every listener will dig into her work at danarfisher.com. Thank you so much for spending time with our listeners, Dana.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Coming up, Australian scientist David Karoly with a frank assessment of climate during retro-fossil politics in America.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
America is threatening allies and abandoning international aid. In response, defense spending is going up in countries like Germany, the UK, and Canada. As climate science is gutted in the United States, countries around the world realize their dependence on everything from U.S. satellites to databases. Will global science take a hit, or can the rest of the world carry the burden? Will climate defense spending go up too? We start with America's staunch military and scientific ally in the Southern Hemisphere, Australia. Our guest is one of the most experienced climate scientists in that country. Dr. David Karoly retired from his post as chief scientist at CSIRO and leader of the Earth Systems and Climate Change Hub. He is now an emeritus professor at the University of Melbourne and a counselor on the Climate Council of Australia. From Melbourne, David Caroli, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Happy to join you and to be available to your listeners. It's a great opportunity. I think it's now more than a decade since I was on EcoShock, and life has changed for me, and life has changed around the world as global temperatures have continued to increase since 2013.
Yes, we've had 10 years of warming since we spoke in 2013, and it hasn't been good, not here and not there in Australia. Do parts of Australian climate science depend on American data machines and institutions that may no longer be available?
Look, as far as I know, the data sets that Australia uses are the sorts of internationally shared weather data that are provided by, for instance, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which are day-to-day weather observations as well as sea surface temperature observations that are fed into Australia's National Weather Service, which is not called the National Weather Service, which is called the Bureau of Meteorology. And it takes in the daily data sets as well as satellite data sets, also from NOAA, as part of its Southern Hemisphere and global weather analysis systems and its weather forecast system. So those data are still available, as far as I'm aware, but it's unclear whether the weather data will continue to be available from NOAA. It is an important component of the NOAA data sets that feed into Australia and feed into every other country around the world. And it is certainly possible, as part of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, that the United States or DOGE or the President decides this data has value and needs to be sold to other countries around the world, but that is against the requirements of the World Meteorological Organization, which encourages and requires the provision of real-time weather data for free to be shared between all countries around the world.
Do you think Australia should try to become more self-sufficient in science, like maybe launching Australian satellites, or would you form new alliances with European agencies like Copernicus?
Yeah, that's a really important and good question. Australia has been involved in research on launching what are essentially low-orbit satellites that collect data sets in terms of observing data sets over the surface. They aren't the polar orbiting weather observing satellites or even the geostationary satellites that are essentially launched by NASA. But there are now Chinese geostationary satellites, Japanese geostationary satellites, as well as weather satellites that are being launched by other countries, including India, and even, as you said, European satellites that have been launched. And so these sorts of different countries are complementing what used to be the leading role that the United States. Australia does not yet have meteorological satellites or geostationary satellites that are available to be used, but it provides ground stations that collect the data and then provide that back to the United States or back to the other countries because they often don't have ground stations in the Southern Hemisphere, south of the equator, like where Australia is located. And therefore, Australia does have ground stations for the geostationary satellites and the polar orbiting satellites to feed data back to the United States as the polar orbiting satellites pass over the Australian landmass.
There's been a big burst of climate research funding in China. Relations between Australia and China have been rocky at times, but do you see more scientific cooperation between your countries, maybe to help fill the gap caused by America's abdication in the field?
As yet, I mean, there has been increases in collaboration and cooperation between Australia and China, both in weather research and in climate research. At the, if you like, what I would call organisation or institutional level, the Bureau of Meteorology in Australia has collaborative agreements with the Chinese meteorological agencies. The CSIRO, the major research organisation, government-funded research organisation in Australia, a little bit like, well, NASA and the National Science Foundation in the United States. That organisation in Australia is called the CSIRO. That's the organisation that I used to work for before I retired. That has collaborative agreements with Chinese research agencies. Those are mainly in the weather and climate space, but not really in what I would describe as the defence industries space, because there is concerns between or around expansion of Chinese interests in the Pacific Ocean region and whether, how would I say, Chinese interests might be potentially threatening to Australian defence security issues, as well as issues of defence and security for Pacific Island nations as well. So that is more of a political consideration. Australia has joined in some defence collaboration with the United States and with the United Kingdom through something called the AUKUS agreement. AUKUS is an acronym, A-U-K-U-S, which is a partnership for Australia to spend an enormously high amount of money on buying submarines for Australia. These are nuclear submarines that only a small fraction of the Australian population wants to have purchased and used in Australia. I'm not a supporter of this AUKUS agreement, and it's still unclear whether the new president of the United States knows about that agreement, because in an interview recently with Australian politicians, he did not know what AUKUS stood for or much about that agreement at all.
Well, maybe that's for the better for now. We'll see. So after a few years of delay, the Australian icebreaker RSV Noina is heading out on its first polar research expedition. There's 60 scientists on board. David, are you excited about that expedition?
Oh, absolutely, because it is critically important to understand the limitations in ocean observations, and particularly under ice observations in the Antarctic region, because there had been delays in both the melting of sea ice and melting of glaciers. The sea ice decline around Antarctica had been somewhat slower than the rapid decline in sea ice in the Arctic regions. And in the last 3 years, there has been a rapid acceleration of the melting of sea ice, or acceleration in the reductions in sea ice around Antarctica. The ocean waters have warmed, and what this means is that there has been an acceleration in the decline of glacier ice and melting of ice below the surface around Antarctica in a number of regions. And this is of concern because there's much greater potential increase in sea level from melting of glacier on ice on land and underwater around Antarctica than the ice in Greenland that also contains substantial reserves of water trapped in the Greenland ice sheet, there's more water trapped in ice in Antarctica, and much greater potential with increasing warming and melting of ice from the Antarctic glaciers to add to ongoing sea level.
Yes, the sea level rise could be amazing if these melt. And I get the feeling from what NASA said about the Thwaites Glacier being unstoppable and other reports that I've had that this is in process, and it's unlikely that once these glaciers start to melt that they will stop. And so really isn't science at this point trying to measure how fast is this going to happen? How quickly do we need to prepare? Maybe are coastal cities safe at all?
Well, we know that even with the most recent IPCC assessment, there was what they described as a best estimate of sea level rise to the end of this century, which was still sounds quite modest, of the order of 1 meter of additional sea level rise this century. But they also provided ongoing projections, because the melting of ice on land, particularly the Antarctic ice sheet and the Greenland ice sheet, continues way beyond, many hundreds of years beyond, the stabilization of global mean temperatures. Even if we reach net zero global emissions, stabilize global temperatures at some level in the future, sea level will continue to rise for many hundreds of years. And so the estimates of sea level rise in 2300, well beyond my lifetime and your lifetime, sea level will continue to rise even after we've stabilized global temperatures for hundreds of years. And if we were to follow what I will describe as the Donald Trump drill baby drill scenario, which is essentially ongoing increases of greenhouse gas emissions from burning fossil fuels, then sea level rise associated with the melting of the Antarctic ice sheet alone, even just the West Antarctic ice sheet alone, would lead to more than 10 meters of sea level rise. And we also know that the last, if you like, interglacial period, the last time we had warmer temperatures than we might get in 2100 due to the drill, baby drill scenario, what I will call the, if you like, ongoing greenhouse gas emissions from burning fossil fuels, the planet would hit 4 degrees or more of global warming. The continents would hit 6 degrees or more of global warming. Antarctica would hit 6 degrees or more of global warming. The West Antarctic ice sheet would lead to 10 meters of sea level rise. That would be a very different planet. And it's also a planet that no Homo sapiens have experienced. The temperatures that I'm talking about are greater than, more than, at any time over the last 200,000 years.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Getting to the fires, I know your country gets intense fires, sometimes several years in a row, but then that can flip to extreme rains and flooding in parts of the country, as recently. Do you think Australians, and maybe the government, tend to forget about bushfire danger during the in-between years? Or is this danger so burned into the national consciousness after Black Saturday and other mass fire events? What do you think?
The acronym that you used, or maybe it's the metaphor that you used, it's not really a metaphor, the name, Black Saturday. Black Saturday actually was massive bushfires in southern and eastern Australia in 2009. And in fact, major bushfires are associated with El Nino events across, affecting Australia, El Nino events in the Pacific Ocean, as many people in the western United States and western Canada are aware of. They have a different impact in Canada. In Australia, we also had even larger fires in the relatively weak 2019 El Niño event, and that was called the Black Summer bushfires. They were the largest area fires across not only southeast Australia, but also right up the eastern coast. And there were fires in much longer than just the hot season. In summer, the fires started in the spring and continued through the summer. And it was called the Black Summer in 2019-2020, recognizing that the summer in the southern hemisphere occurs between December and February. And we're just literally today, for me, it's just the end of the summer, and we have had another very hot summer this year across Australia with significant bushfires. It's not as hot as 2018-19 or 2019-2020. It will be the third hottest summer that we have just experienced. But if we look over a slightly longer period, the winter, spring and summer, the last 9 months, has set a new record high across Australia, consistent with the ongoing impacts of higher greenhouse gas emissions and the ongoing impacts of greenhouse gas emissions on climate change, not only in Australia but around the planet, remembering that 2024 set a new record high global temperature, more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial level. We have had this summer in Australia substantial bushfires and grass fires, because what we've experienced had been wet years over the last few years, and that leads to increases in plant growth that has dried out over the last 3 to 6 months, and that means we've had very predominant grass fires and scrub fires, but not as many forest fires. And that is somewhat similar to the experience in Los Angeles a couple of months ago, or about a month ago, where the change from wet conditions over a few years in Southern California, the switch to then a very high temperatures in the fall season and in the winter season in Southern California, where they had an extended dry period and high temperatures, led to extreme fire danger and then massive fires affecting Los Angeles. And I know Canada and Western Canada has also had massive switches between wet years and then followed by dry seasons, which have led to major wildfires in Western Canada and across California as well. And that's being described as, by some people, the climate whiplash that's being accelerated by ongoing global warming.
You know, both of our countries are almost wealthy enough to withstand and rebuild from some of these climate-powered hits like fires or floods, up to a point. But developing countries, they can't afford to deal with the impacts. And there was supposed to be a United Nations fund to help those countries. It's often been promised and always underfunded. Now one of the major funders, the United States, appears to be withdrawing from all that. Should we be concerned?
Well, as you said, depends on whether we are the residents of Canada, the United States, and Australia. And as you said, we are relatively affluent, you know, communities, societies in those countries. But there are actually, in Australia, significant homeless people, and also in Indigenous people living in the inland areas in Australia, that are absolutely going to be affected by the increases in temperature extremes, increases in fires, and there are the natural ecosystems, the plants, the animals, the birds, the insects are all being affected by these increases in temperature extremes, increases in wildfires across the country. And then we also have to think of the ethical considerations for poorer countries, as you mentioned, countries like Papua New Guinea to the north of Australia, the Pacific Island countries, Africa, Southeast Asia, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan are all being affected by changes in climate, increases in climate extremes, and I will be visiting South Africa for a science-related meeting about the impact of climate change in Southern Africa. So I will be using the information and experience from Australia to explain what sorts of things are needed. And yes, it's the resources, not just educational resources, but the infrastructure that is needed to try to address climate change. And what we need to try to do is provide the capabilities to avoid the ongoing manageable impacts. So we've got to manage the unavoidable impact of climate change, the impacts due to warming that we've experienced already, but we've also got to provide to developing countries the capacity and capabilities to move away from a fossil fuel energy system to a renewable energy system where they harvest the energy from the sun and harvest the energy from the wind to provide renewable energy sources in developing countries as they transition away from a fossil fuel energy system that is the dominant cause of the problem of global warming.
And, you know, the same people who want to slash climate aid also are worried about mass immigration. But if crops fail or it's just too hot to live, millions of humans may have to move. And then, you know, it would be great if people realized the immigration and climate connection. Do you think people in Australia get that?
It is clear that within Australia, most people are of a similar view that immigration from developing countries is not going to benefit Australia. But you're absolutely right that immigration from developing countries, what are sometimes described as climate refugees, Australia is providing some support for people from developing Pacific Island countries that are losing their land because of sea level rise, their agricultural opportunities, and even their freshwater opportunities. They're losing their country, they're losing their culture, and Australia has said that it will provide some what would be described as land in Australia to allow them to relocate. However, Australia is one of the biggest exporters of coal and fossil gas mined from within Australia. It's selling it overseas to make money. And Australia's exports of fossil fuels make it the third largest exporter of fossil fuels in the world. And those export-related emissions of coal and fossil gas in Australia are more than double its domestic emissions. Australia's domestic emissions have been falling since 2005, except the last couple of years, but its exports of coal and fossil gas have dramatically increased in Australia, or should I say both the Australian government and the Australian opposition parties both want to continue selling Australia's fossil fuels overseas to make money for Australia. That is a crazy situation where Australia is being impacted by climate change caused by global emissions, and yet Australia wants to sell more fossil fuels overseas to increase global emissions of carbon dioxide. It doesn't make sense to me, and I am strongly opposed to that. In my public statements, even yesterday I was on the radio talking about that craziness, and it will be the case. Australia has a national election later this year. The date has not yet been set, but there will be an Australian election, and it is unclear what would be the policy on exports of fossil fuels from Australia. Both parties at present support that action.
Welcome to Canada. We're exactly the same. We talk a good climate game at times, but in fact, we're just accelerating our exports of LNG. A new port is opening up this spring to export it. And of course, we're talking about opening new coal mines in Alberta, if you can believe that. And the tar sands are pumping out more than ever. So we've got the same big problem right here in Canada, and I think in any fossil fuel producing country, we have to include Norway. We have to, you know, everybody's going to have to look in the mirror and see where their products are going. From Melbourne, Australia, we've been speaking with eminent scientist Dr. David Karoly. He is the author of over 250 scientific publications, and he's been a government advisor. You can find links to follow up on the news and science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you for spending time with our listeners in Australia and around the world.
You're most welcome and happy to do it. Maybe we can reduce the frequency of your discussions with me from once every decade or so to maybe once every few years. And the one topic we didn't touch on is nuclear power in Australia or not. It is an issue that the opposition party in Australia is pushing very, very hard on to achieve net zero emissions in Australia by 2050, says it all we need to do is to switch to nuclear power. And that is a recipe for all sorts of problems, and I'm happy to talk about it, but I am very strongly opposed to it.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Just a note, scientists are disappearing from my requests for radio interviews, afraid to talk about their own work. Suddenly, lots of people, including previous guests, are traveling, too engaged in a project to talk. We're just not replying to out-of-agency media requests. Meanwhile, after several weeks of personal hair-on-fire moments, including upsetting threats to take over my own home country of Canada, my brain has been singed. Many months of new programs, I need a week or so to rethink, rebuild, and explore the shaking landscape. I'm looking for those frontiers that desperately need sunlight and your ears. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
You can put us down. You can't keep us down. Shout down reason. Fire all the experts. Storms still come. Heat will melt the roads. You order waves to stop. But you cannot nuke a new. Against the truth, send them all to jail, expel the kids, every life on sale, but no matter what he did, wanna be king, and his kangaroo court, a million eyes, see right inside the fort. Pray for you, but not for your health, as it was in the past. The big wheel turns, the first shall be last. Got a crazy idea to play with people's lives. Think you are the greatest. Every prize, getting smaller on the stage, you age, history moves on, leave you like a stain, on time, cures the pain of your time, and moves on. Close down the streets, call out the troops, there is no defense against the truth.
When the people rise, determination in their eyes, we can.
Please, please, support your local radio station with a good donation. TV has totally sold out to the big corporate machine, and they're losing viewers. Nonprofit radio is one of the last stands of advertising free speech. I count on you to put your money where your ears are by supporting your nonprofit radio station.